My name is Carol Avery. I still consider myself a Wisconsinite, though it's been many years since I've lived there. And we've been in Saudi Arabia now for 3 years and are going back again in August for a fourth, and then there'll be the big question next spring whether or not to sign another 2-year contract or not, so we're not sure. I'm by no means a public speaker, so you'll have to excuse me. In fact, this is the second in my lecture circuit cross country, my first being the West Denmark LCW Pie Social 2 summers ago, and this is my second one. I don't know if I have too many calls from here on after. I don't really think so. Anyway, I found it interesting after we had written to Elmer back and forth all this year and made these arrangements. Then at the last minute, right before I left, I finally got his packet of information that had our names listed in there as appearing this summer, and it listed under global missions. And I thought, oh goodness, I don't know if that's a very, if I can live up to that title. I'd like to think that we were doing wonderful mission work. If we are, it's subtle. It's it's hard to live in a country where your faith has to be suppressed all the time. It's absolutely forbidden to worship in any other manner other than Islam. In fact, we find that there are a lot of Mormons that come over, and I think many of them have high anticipations of proselytizing. And last year, there was a big upheaval where one of the head Mormons was caught doing his preaching on, I don't know if it was on the streets or where. And a lot of them were given 24-hour notice to get out of the country. It was just like that. So that's one thing we kind of struggle with in living where we do is the religious side of our life is lacking, I think, in a lot of ways. We do meet once a week with a group of Christians on campus, and that keeps us going in a way. But it's hard. It's very hard to have to be wary all the time. But anyway, tonight I just wanted to talk about, I'm going to do the simple stuff. I'm just talk about the everyday life kind of general background, because both John and I are doing a lot more kind of more detailed presentations, and it helps to have the background that we can refer back to in later times. So we'll start with a little map here. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the Middle East because it's always on the headlines these days in so many ways. But I discovered that I learned a lot after going there. In fact, this past spring when the whole Libya incident happened, somebody said that they'd gotten a call from someone in the U.S. who said they weren't sure where Libya was. He said, can you imagine that? But I got to thinking about it, and I thought, I'm not sure I knew where Libya was before I moved to the Middle East, and now it all seems so near and close, and we talk about it, and friends of ours travel these places all the time. But I think you don't really see the picture that much living here. So basically, Saudi Arabia, one mass of desert for the most part. And we're way over here on the, interesting. Here it says Persian Gulf. This is not printed in Saudi Arabia. They will always call it the Arabian Gulf and wouldn't be disappointed to see this called the Persian Gulf. But we are very, very close to the Gulf there. In fact, we spend many a weekend at the beach, which is beautiful swimming, and which is also about the only thing there is to do on the weekend, so that's another reason. Riyadh is the capital of Saudi Arabia, right, in kind of plunk in the middle, very much desert. And then Jeddah down here is the other big city, kind of our three, Dhahran, where we live, Riyadh and Jeddah are where most of the expatriates are living now, except for those that are in the oil, out, you know, on the rigs, working in the oil lines that are scattered throughout the country. But quite Western, especially where we live, and Jeddah as well is really quite Western. I haven't been there. I hear it's beautiful along the Red Sea, and it's supposed to be beautiful for diving and snorkeling. I hope we can make it there one of these days. Then there's the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Yemen down here, Qatar. We have some good friends who are moving to Qatar in the fall for a job, so they want us to drive over in our January break. And I hope we can do this a very short distance, but getting across the border is not a very easy accomplishment, so I'm not sure. And Bahrain, which is a separate country, is right off the coast, and they have just now finished, it isn't quite open, but a multi-million dollar causeway that now goes from Saudi Arabia over to Bahrain. And we're excited. It's only about a 5-minute drive for us to get to the causeway. But we've heard rumor that it's not going to be very accessible. It probably will only be used for transportation, for trekking and such. So we had high hopes of being able to jump in our car and spend a weekend in Bahrain, and I don't think that's going to be possible. And then, of course, Iraq and Iran, which we all hear too much about, I'm afraid, and Jordan. Another indication that this map is not from Saudi Arabia is they list Israel. In Saudi Arabia, that would be blacked out, and Palestine would be written in there. Egypt, and there's Libya stuck over there. So we were not very familiar with the area before moving there. We have not traveled very much. We've only been to Jordan overnight in Amman. And I hope to do more. It's just with little children, it's often more work to travel than it is to stay at home. Probably, as you all know, it's very much of a desert country with oases here and there, which are a real refreshing sight to see. We often like to travel to a town about 80 miles away, which is a beautiful oasis, and it's as green as far as you can see, with date palms. And that's a real nice, refreshing change of scenery because it's very barren where we are. And lawns are few and far between. There are quite a few trees, though. They've done a lot of planting that way. I'm pleased with that. Do you have a question?
Could you say again what you were doing there?
I'm sorry. I meant to say that. John is teaching English at the University of Petroleum and Minerals. That's how we got there, because he got his job.
Is that an American company?
No, it's completely Saudi. Not a woman on on the whole university campus. He sees a sea of gutras every day that he teaches. But then, in the meantime, I've gotten a job teaching at the American, well, it's actually called Saudi Arabian International Schools, but it's a completely American curriculum. All the textbooks, everything is American. So it's much like teaching here, except that I have such an international classroom. Probably 12 nationalities is not unusual in my one classroom. So, but
what
I kinda,
language do you use?
And it's all in English.
It is.
As well as the Saudi University, which is unusual because it would be like us having a university completely in French or something in our country. But because it's a technical university, they chose to teach all in English.
Children.
Not Saudi children, though. The school where I teach, there are no Saudi children whatsoever. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few Muslim children from other Arab countries, but no Saudi children. So, yeah, I'm sorry. So that's what we've been doing. Although I've only just really started teaching in January. I'd done some work a couple years before there. But anyway, so it's a desert climate, very hot from May till October. Last week, 2 weeks ago, thankfully my husband had left with the girls 2 weeks early because he was done before. It hit 120 degrees in the shade. I've never, ever felt heat like I did that day. It was absolutely unbearable. It reminded me of going to a wiener roast with a huge bonfire where you're trying to cook your hot dog, but you try to get closer and closer, and it's so hot you kind of go like this. It was just like being in that situation and not being able to get out of it that day. And it was a work day for me at school because we had report cards and such. The children weren't there. So we were in and out from building to building a lot that day. And so one of my friends, another teacher, decided to put her thermometer in the sun because she said, after all, we're walking in the sun. And it wasn't 2 minutes and the mercury had gone absolutely to the top and broke. It was over 140. But that's unusual. We've never felt it that hot. But then we're fortunate to not have to spend the summers there either. So. But the winters are beautiful. They're very mild. January can be very cold. Windy, a lot of sand blowing. So we have to wear sweaters and jackets in January, sometimes February. But it's not uncommon to swim into December and then again in March. So the cold season is really not that cold either. So we can't complain too much. And everything is air conditioned, our house, our car, work. So it's only in getting out and about that is the problem. I have written down workdays versus weekends, which doesn't sound like a real major thing, but the weekend in Saudi Arabia is Thursday and Friday. And to me, that was the hardest thing to get over anything else, was to get used to that, having the weekend on Thursday and Friday. And I still, to this day, do it to my kids in school. When I talk about health, which is on Monday morning, I inevitably say Wednesday morning, because in my mind, it's the middle of the week. And they'll say, Wednesday? What do you mean Wednesday? And I have to rethink it. Okay, Monday. So even after 3 years, it takes a long time. John had that problem at the beginning. He said, on a Wednesday afternoon, he'd give them assignment due Monday morning, meaning, you know, first thing in the beginning of the week. And so Saturday morning would come and nobody had the assignment done because he had told them Monday morning. It's amazing how hard that has been to get over. And I still slip back into thinking. And it seems so natural to come here and have Sunday be Sunday and not Friday. So that took some getting used to. We live on campus, the University of Petroleum and Minerals campus, as does all the faculty. And boy, I don't know how much housing there is, but thousands of families live there. And it's divided into different compounds. It's just some are older than others. It's as they've expanded, they've built new compounds. So we're in one of the newer ones, which is an advantage in a way that our house has a lot of modern appliances and such. But it's also very sparse. There are the trees that have been planted are not very tall. There's no grass at all. The whole compound is kind of tile, brick, throughout the whole compound. Whereas North Compound, which is the oldest, the original compound, the houses are in horrific shape. So we were offered to move there, offered a house for next fall, and we decided against it. But the lawns are beautiful and the trees are tall, and so it's you have to decide what your priority is. Question. Sand colored. Everything is sand colored. Brownish tan. The houses are. No, yeah, it's kind of a. I don't know why they do that. The houses are all the same color, too. It all looks like sand, pretty much. But, yes?
You talk about thousands of families. How many students are in this university?
Oh, where's John when I need him? 2,000 maybe? I'll double check with him. I can't remember offhand. It starts out quite a number. In the first year, they all have to take English for 1 year, which is what John teaches. And then only about 60% of those pass that first year that go on to university. And then a lot fall out along the way. So it's a fluctuating number. I'll have to double check. I just can't remember. But anyway, the university consists of the actual classrooms, which is called the Jebel, Jebel meaning hill, and it's on a hill, and that's where all the academics takes place. Women are really not supposed to be on the Jebel, except that they built the clinic up there. So of course, you know, we have to get to the clinic, but they still frown upon it. So new clinic has now been built, which is across the street from the Jebel, I think mainly to keep us away. They don't like the students having views of Western women, I guess. But other than that, there's nothing for me to. There is a library there. I've heard a very good library, but it's only open to women for 2 hours on Friday morning, and I've yet to make it that time. So basically, women are not to go on the Jebel. It's only for the clinic. Then we do have a beautiful recreation center, which is well used by all of us. There are two swimming pools there, a men's swimming pool and a women's swimming pool. And although this past year the women's swimming pool has been under repair, so we've had to have hours in the men's pool, women's hours and men's hours. And the children generally come with the women, although if they're real young children, they can go with either. And we have a grocery store now, which last year was expanded, and it's wonderful. It's not huge, but most everything we need on a day-to-day basis we can get right there on campus, because it's about a 15-20 minute drive into town. So if it's just bread or milk you need, it's nice to be able to get it right there. Although driving is forbidden in Saudi Arabia, Women are allowed to drive, although not officially, but we're allowed to drive on campus as far as the recreation center and the grocery store. We're not allowed to drive up on the Jebel, the university, where the classrooms are.
Was that hard for you to get used to, women being put down like that?
Yes. It was. I'm so grateful to be able to drive on campus because it's a mile from where we live to the recreation center, and it's a long walk for the children in hot weather. So, and actually there's a lot of talk now about that women might be able to drive. There's a lot of rumblings that maybe they'll be given driver's licenses. But I'm not sure I would anyway, even if I was given the opportunity. The driving situation is rather horrific, and I just don't like the thought of me being stranded somewhere in town. If it's on campus, it's all right there. But it's not official. I mean, as far as the books would read, it would say women cannot drive, but they just tell security to turn their heads if they see a woman and not to. It is a little bit risky because our insurance company says right out that if I were in any accident whatsoever, I would not be covered. And so I don't like driving at night. And I'm always a little nervous, especially with children running out in the street and such. But I still drive to the store and to the rec center. And that's another disadvantage of this north compound, the old one, which is so beautifully green. It's situated on the other end of the university, on the other side of the Jebel. So the women there are not allowed to drive at all because it would mean driving by the Jebel. And I would find that very restrictive. Yes?
Don't they have any public transportation at all?
Any public transportation? On campus we have a shuttle bus that runs once an hour from 7 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And it makes just a big loop once an hour around campus. Now, to get to town, the university does have a shopping bus that goes two mornings a week and one evening a week that women generally take to town. Other than that, if you want public transportation, you can get it. You have to first get up to the north end of campus, which involves riding the shuttle bus up there, and then standing in the road and waiting for it. And then I've taken it a few times, but the women have to sit in the back of the bus in a compartment. It's walled off back there. So we have to sit in the back, which tends to get hot, and you can't ever see where to get off. That's the hard part because you can't see out of the window. I mean, there's windows along the side in the back, but then it's all, you know, covered in front of you. So I'm always panicky to go on that bus because I'm afraid I'll end up somewhere and never know how to get off. But I have taken it a few. It's kind of an adventure. It's sort of fun to do. If you don't have children, I don't like doing it with children. But I've taken it several times. But it's such an ordeal that it's seldom that I do. But it's an experience.
Have you had your face covered and riding on the bus?
I don't know. Never. Western women never have to have their face covered. But this was my anticipatory set, as we call it in teaching. This is what I would wear shopping. Just about. Basically, this is actually from India. My husband got it for me. Something just long and loose. Should be long sleeve, although I have several short sleeve ones that I do wear in the hot weather. And around most places I shop, there's so many Westerners there that it's not really noticed. But there are some more very Arab areas where we ended up kind of by mistake one day at Christmas time. We were looking for some riding toy for our daughter, I guess. And I had worn, I think, a long skirt and then short sleeves. And we ended up in this area not thinking we would, and I felt very conspicuous. I just hated that feeling. I was the only woman at all, and then being a Western woman with my arms showing, I felt stared at constantly, and it was my fault that we hadn't thought we'd end up there. But in the main shopping area, because it's so Western, short sleeves are generally all right, and once in a while I've worn a calf-length dress, but not usually. But on campus it's much more casual, where I'd never wear shorts, but I would wear a calf-length dress a lot, and short sleeves a lot. Jeans, that's okay. Mm-hmm. On campus, I wouldn't wear jeans to town. It's a little bit frowned on because it outlines the shape of your legs, and they don't like that too much. So, but on campus, yeah, we wear quite a few jeans. our compounds are very international. And to me, this is the best part about living there, is that we have the people who teach here come from literally all around the world. And of course, we're all living right together. And it's wonderful that way, to have friends from just every part of the globe. And people who always say, stop by and visit sometime. And we always try to do so if we can. So just in our immediate, where we live, we have upstairs neighbors who are Algerian, and we have an Indian couple across the walkway, and we have an Egyptian couple next door, and another Egyptian family down the way, and across the way an American man married to a Filipino wife, which we find a lot of mixed marriages. I think it's a nice neutral ground for people to live on, is my feeling, when you have mixed cultures. I can see where it would be hard to live one place or the other, but this is kind of a completely different, neutral area.
Are all of those involved in the campus?
Mm-hmm. They're all teachers, all of them.
Uh-huh. And they all teach in English?
No. Many of them teach math, chemistry, all the engineering fields. But some of them are English teachers, too.
So. They all teach in English.
But they all teach in English.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I'm sorry. Yes, they are. Which, to me, I feel so sorry for these students, because I have a hard time understanding English, a lot of these people who haven't spoken for... The Ghanaian people, we have some good Ghanaian friends, but they talk so fast, I have a hard time keeping up. And I always think, these poor Saudi students who have all these different teachers from all these different nationalities speaking English, it must be terribly confusing for them, but I don't know. Somehow they must manage. I think that quite a few of the people who come from Arab countries probably teach in Arabic, though they're not supposed to. But I can see where it would be very difficult not to. That's your native language, and it's your student's native language. I'm sure there's quite a bit, at least, of translation going on. But it's not. It's supposed to be all English.
Do they give them any kind of assistance with the language after that first year?
Yes, they have the first year, and then they have a university English program, which actually John is teaching in the university English program now. When they're freshmen and sophomores, I believe, they're required to take an English course. And that's more advanced composition, writing, technical writing, that kind of thing, report writing. But the first year is all the conversation, listening, reading, grammar, all that type. So then, El Khobar is the name of the town where we do most of our shopping, and that's why I said it was about a 15-minute drive from us. And it's quite Western. There is a Safeway there, although it is just now, the past month or so, Safeway no longer has it, and I'm not sure what happened, if they were forced to sell it out, but they still have Safeway products. I don't know if they're in a transition period, but I'm sure it will remain very much like Safeway. Very expensive. We rarely shop there, but if you need something that's very unusual, then you're pretty sure you can get it there.
Do they run like our supermarkets here?
Basically, uh-huh. Yeah, they do. They try to have it a lot look like a regular Safeway would be here. And then
who shops there? Just the foreigners?
Pretty much the foreigners. Well, no, that's not true. There are quite a few Saudis in there, too. But the majority are Westerners who shop there. And there are several shopping centers that are like that, quite Western. And then there's others that are less Western, but have a lot of products that we use. We go to one called Dahran Shopping Center, which is just a grocery store, but it has a lot of local products, too, so it tends to be quite a bit cheaper. And it's like flour. They have a Saudi flour company that's very, very cheap, probably 10 cents a pound or something for the flour there. So that's where I like to go to do my shopping.
Do they import most of their food?
Most, although they're trying to make it so that a lot is produced in-country, and quite a bit is. They have a dairy now, a Saudi dairy. In fact, several. One is a Saudi-Danish dairy. This flour is Saudi flour. Now, I've heard that they have wheat fields. I have yet to see any. I'm not sure where they are. But they are really experimenting and trying to be able to be more self-sufficient. But the vast majority of products are imported.
Mostly American products?
No, mostly European products. Largely European products. The few American products that there, Safeway would have a lot of American products. but they're very expensive. Like you buy Pillsbury flour and it's, what would that be, about $6 for a can that's, you know, about like this. And I find the few times I've had the American flour, it tends to have bugs in it because it's been such a long time from being transferred from country to country. So I like to buy the Saudi produce and local produce as much as possible. A lot of the fresh fruits and vegetables come from Turkey and Jordan and Greece, those countries, and some are just wonderful, really beautiful produce. So in the downtown, Safeway and these other shopping centers sort of lie on the outskirts. And then the downtown center section is more small shops that specialize in one thing, like there'll be a houseware shop. And where there's a houseware shop, there'll probably be a whole string of houseware shops. And then you get into hardware shops, and there'll be a kind of hardware shop section. And there'll be small fruit and vegetable stands that have beautiful produce. And I love shopping there. It's just that it's out of the way often to get there. It's easier to go to the big store and get everything at once. But I do get quite a few things there. There are a lot of electronics stores, which seems so odd, but you'll hear blaring rock music coming out of some of these shops, and they really try to sell the electronic goods. There are many, many people working there from the Philippines, from Thailand, from Korea, and they tend to buy because they're quite cheap there. There are no taxes in Saudi Arabia. It's quite cheap to buy this kind of equipment there. And they actually buy it and take it back home and then resell it and make a little profit on it. But there's a lot of that. And so they have tapes just of every kind imaginable. The thing that bothers me is all those tapes are pirated. They're very, very cheap. It's because they come from somewhere that copies the original and resells them, which of course is illegal in this country. But people buy them up by the scores. And just about any kind from, I guess, the most modern. I don't even know what's modern anymore, but most any kind of music that you would want to find. And then there's the gold souks, which are always fun. Souks means market, and all these are, there's vegetable souks and the houseware souks, and the gold souks are always fun to go in, though I have yet to purchase very much there. Gold jewelry, everybody goes on, all my Western friends go on and on about how cheap it is, meaning in comparison to here, it's very cheap. It's all 18 or 21 karat gold, which is very difficult to get in the U.S. And for being that pure of gold, it is, I guess, cheap, but it's still expensive as far as I'm concerned. And there is no tax either, which makes it quite a bit cheaper. Most of it's imported from Italy. But these shops are really dazzling to go into. The gold hanging everywhere. And it just glitters. It's always kind of exciting. I always go in and price a few things and leave again, act like I'm interested. But I guess, like a gold necklace, I have one that was given to me. I guess about $80 it would cost, but it's 18 karat gold. Nothing fancy, just kind of a band of gold, which for those people who are used to buying jewelry in the U.S., apparently that's a real good price. I'm not really a jewelry person, so I don't know that much. But it's always fun to go in there and look. In fact, the first year we were there, John was turning 30 on the 30th, which meant it was his golden birthday. So I thought, oh, how appropriate this would be if I went and bought him something in gold. So a friend and I, this was one time we took this bus. It's kind of a harrowing experience, the whole thing. But we went into a gold souk in another town. And, of course, the only thing really for men were cufflinks, which you don't wear very often. But John does have one nice shirt that he could wear cufflinks. So I went and I looked at some that looked very plain and very simple, and I asked them the price, and then they told me it was like $300. And I kind of looked, and I looked at my friend, and she said, "Do you suppose you could just get one?" I ended up getting a 1 gram piece of gold for about $15, just as I thought it was symbolic enough, so I still haven't. But it's always fun to go there and to look around. So generally for shopping, except in the big stores, Safeway, the Western stores where everything is priced, there's rarely a price on anything, which still drives me crazy sometimes. And if there is a price, you still never generally never just pay the price. If it says 15 reals, then you say, how about 10 reals? And you usually, it's expected that you barter for prices, which took me a long time to get used to. I'm still not very good at it. I still tend to just pay it because I don't, but some people are kind of hurt if you don't barter. And that can be kind of fun to get into a lively disagreement or then say, well, you know, give me two for this price or something. And generally there, I bought a camera, I guess, and we had looked at cameras everywhere. And they were around 400 reals, I guess, which is about, $120 or so. And then we came to one shop, the same camera that I'd looked at for 400. We asked how much, and he said, 350. And John said, 350? And he said, okay, 300. John was like, 350? Like, is that all? And he took it like, what do you mean 350? So he gave it to us for 300. Well, this is a deal. But that kind of thing happens a lot. And it's fun. It's fun. But never in the real Western stores. There you would not ever barter because the prices are on, just as you would shop here. The further away you get from the main town, the more rural areas, and the more you expect that because they see you're an American, that the price they ask is probably at least double of what they really have in mind to get for it. The main problem with shopping that still bothers me is that because it's an Islam society, they have prayer call 5 times a day, and when there's prayer call, everything shuts down for about 20 minutes to a half an hour for people to go and pray. And so if you're shopping and it's prayer call, then just like that, the lights go out and they come over the loudspeaker and say, Salah, Salah, which means prayer, prayer, get out, get out. And you have to go and stand outside while they just close everything down, lock all the doors, and you sit and wait for 20 minutes. And prayer call comes, it depends on the season because it's always based on the sun. Sunrise, noon, dawn. No, how is it? There's one extra one in there. Sunrise, dawn, noon, evening, and then sunset. So it changes all the time. You have to always check your prayer schedule to tell when prayer call will be if you want to try to shop around it. But there's usually two fairly close together in the evening, so that's can be frustrating if you go in the evening wanting to get a lot done and then keep getting interrupted by prayer call and you have to sit outside in the heat while everything closes down. If you go out to eat, sometimes they'll let you sit in the restaurant and eat during prayer call. They'll lock the doors, but they may let you stay in there and eat, depending on the restaurant. Some won't do that either. So that, to me, shopping, that's the most frustrating thing.
Yeah, did they just get right out in the street and put down their prayer mat?
Not in the street, but there's usually a designated area, kind of a lawn or an open area, where it's just something to see. You know, just rows and rows and rows of men, always, and they're doing they have their certain ritual that they do of bowing and praying.
Don't pray at all?
The women pray only at home. Oh. They're not allowed to pray, I don't think allowed. I've never seen them pray in any gathering sense at all. And I've never seen women going into the mosque, the church. I don't know if it's actually forbidden, but it definitely is not really acceptable. So women are expected to stay home and pray with their family that way, which is a discrepancy. Pardon?
Do they have to wear a veil?
Yes. Yes, the Saudi women always are veiled. And in the part we live in, it's a completely black veil. Black material. There's another kind, and I have a veil and abaya with me, which I'm going to be wearing tomorrow night at a little presentation we're giving. Mine is open at the eyes, which is common in another part of the country. The women there always have. It's a band here and a little slat, and then it's a veil from there down. So at least you can see something. I think it would be so difficult to try to get around being completely covered in black. But yes, they are always veiled and always covered if they're Saudi women. I think the women who have the hardest time in Saudi Arabia are other Arab women, like from Turkey and Jordan, where they don't veil so much. Even though they're Muslim, they're much more loose. But the Saudis will really zero in on them and get after them for not being veiled, whereas I guess they've kind of given up on us because Sometimes, though, we are told to wear a scarf. I should carry a scarf with me, but I don't always. I kind of forget.
How about the children? Birds, how are they involved?
Children?
Yeah, what constitutes a child?
Puberty is the real turning point. Up until puberty, children are just children, pretty much like here. They play together and they, there aren't very many divisions. And then when they reach puberty, and I don't know what the exact age is, that's when they're pretty much an adult, and that's when the girls are expected to veil and cover up. In my sixth grade class, which would be 11 and 12 year olds, I guess, this past month has been the Saudi, the Islam holy month of Ramadan, where they fast all day. They're not allowed to eat from sunrise to sunset. Not only eat, but drink, which to me would be pure torture. When it was 120 degrees that day and they could not touch a glass of water. Well, in my classroom I had four boys who started out fasting, and only one was still fasting by the end of the month. So at that age, I think they're trying to be like the adults, but they don't have to be. They can give out, and that it probably isn't frowned upon. So I don't know if it's an exact age, but it's right in there somewhere. These boys were in transition anyway, where they should be starting to follow the rules, but didn't really have to. How about if you ask more questions before I go on to other things? I don't know what you want to hear about.
How do you dress normally?
Like I said, this is what I would wear going to town. Right, yes. Generally long sleeves and always a long dress or a long skirt. And I usually carry a scarf around with me so I can put it on.
On your face or on your head or where?
Just on my head, tied around my head. There are religious police. They're called the Mutawa. I have yet to meet a Mutawa. I'm not even sure what one looks like. But I have many friends who have been stopped by the Mutawa. I should not say they've been stopped. The trick is, if you're alone as a woman, the Mutawa would never come up and talk to you. But if they see you with your husband, they will go to him and tell him to have his wife cover her head. And they write out some kind of a notice. And if you don't have a scarf right there, you're expected to go and find one and cover your head. I've never met a Mutawa, but I know I have quite a few friends who have. But I guess maybe I don't shop with John that much. I like to go in with the ladies. And apparently, I've been told, and I've never yet known of a religious police going up just to a woman and telling her. So it's got to be because I'm pretty much my husband's property that he should be keeping me in line. Yes?
Very many poor
people, very seldom. Once in a while, we've seen beggars. In fact, about a week before we came back, we were in a travel agent getting our tickets, and a lady came in, and it took me a while to figure out what it was she wanted, but she wanted money, I could tell. And she was just kind of wandering around holding out her hand, and that's very unusual to see. The poor people, and you very seldom see old people either. And they're pretty much just taken care of by their families, and I think stay at home most of the time.
Disabled people?
Saudis tend to have a lot of eye problems, and you do see a lot of cross-eyed people and people with very thick glasses, and foot problems. Now, I've been told that's because there's a lot of intermarriage of cousins and such, that these things have come about. Other people have said the eye problems are from all the dust and the sand, that things are easily carried. I'm not sure exactly what. Those are the two in particular. You see, I see a lot of children, like with a big sort of growth beside their eye, and I often wonder exactly what it is. But not really disabled. I've never seen anyone in a wheelchair or on crutches, and there would be absolutely no way you could manage, because sidewalks are, you know, huge curbs here and ruts here, and it's all I can do to walk on the sidewalks, especially pushing a stroller. But if you were handicapped, I don't see how you could possibly get around. So I don't know what happens to young people who are. There's one young boy on campus I've noticed who seems to be a dwarf, and I've often wondered what's going to happen to him. I doubt if there's much opportunity for him to get any help.
Mm-hmm. Are you and your husband studying Arabic?
Oh, I'm so ashamed to say no. I always said I would never live in a foreign country and not learn the language. But where we live, because it's so Western, we rarely hear Arabic. We hear it during prayer call, and we hear it once in a while, but everything is spoken in English. And I'm not proud of that fact at all. I don't like to feel like they have to accommodate me to speak English. I have a very good friend, an Egyptian friend, who lives down the way, and I'm always apologizing for her that we have to speak in English. Her English is very good, and she always says, oh, I love to speak in English, I love to practice. But I don't feel good about that. It's only been because of the classes that have been offered have been at very awkward times, late at night and such. And there was a women's Arabic class for a while, and then with my teaching, that got in the way. So, no, I wish we spoke more. We have good friends from Colorado who studied Arabic intensively before they went over and before they had children, which was a big help. And they've gotten to know many more Saudis than any other Western people I know. But they make a constant effort at doing that, too. And they go to the very Arabic sections of town and barter in Arabic to keep it up, which I admire a lot. Right now they're in Jordan studying at a summer Arabic training session. So,
you said,
Are the students at the university all Saudi students, or are they from other Arab?
At the university, the students are, a vast majority are Saudi, but there are other Arab students too, quite a few Jordanians, a few Egyptians perhaps. I don't know if there are any others. And there is one American student. His parents teach there and have taught there for years, and he's studying there, which I think they had to do some finagling to get the university to accept him. But he's a friend of ours who lives very close to us, and he's getting his degree in some petroleum area, I think.
So. What is healthcare like for the Saudis?
Healthcare. Where we live, it's very good. We have, like I said, the clinic right on campus, which is free care for anybody at the university. And we have a wonderful pediatrician who I'm ever so grateful to have there. He's an Indian fellow who's, the children just love him. He's so good. Then there are a staff of doctors. I think one or two are Saudi. I've never seen them before. Others tend to be more Pakistani, Indian, Egyptian. They had a gynecologist there for a while who was a woman gynecologist, Saudi, who was very useless, I'm told. I think I heard she got her degree by correspondence course. I don't know if that's true, but from the reports I heard, I think it is. So I've been very pleased that just this past winter they've gotten a male gynecologist, which is kind of a frowned on thing in their culture. He's wonderful, and he's a retired gynecologist from Aramco, the big oil company. He's only there in the afternoons, but I've been so grateful to have him. But then for any hospital care, there are government hospitals, which is free, completely free, but which I've heard many not so good reports about, so I had considered briefly going to a government hospital to have this one and decided against it after the last report I heard. And then there are quite a few private hospitals, which I'm very pleased with. The care seems excellent. The hospitals themselves, I think, are more like what we would maybe have seen in the 50s in this country. Very stark white, all white tiled floors, white tiled walls. You know, nothing aesthetic about them whatsoever. But very clean and very modern equipment. They have the most modern of equipment that's available because they've had the money to purchase it. So I'm very happy.
The reason I ask is the school that I'm with has a hospital administration program, and we always have a group of Saudi Arabian students that seem to be there to be training them, and always go back, and the government has sent them. And I just
interesting
wondered if that is a thrust of the government to upgrade that kind of thing.
I would guess that the government has had a series of five-year plans, and I think they're in their third of their five-year plans right now. And by the end of this, I think five-year plans, their goal is to have no more expatriates in their country, which they're not even close to realizing. But the effort is to have their own people trained, which makes sense. I think that they're right to do that. I don't see it as being a very realistic goal, certainly not in the near future. I don't see very many Saudi doctors at the hospitals. A lot of Egyptian, like I said, Pakistani, Indian, but very few Saudis. Maybe it's just that I haven't seen them myself, but I'm very happy with the health care. Seems very good. So, yes.
Well, your daily schedule, do the shops close at noon and do the classes close down at noon or?
In my school or
not
in
the,
shopping?
Well, the university or?
Oh, university. Shopping. Just closes for prayer time.
But
and there's a prayer.
Do you have a noon siesta like they do in some of the
Oh, some of the shops do. Yes, actually, the stores do in town. They usually are closed from the morning prayer time, which is between 11:30 and 12, and then they open again at 3 in the afternoon.
And all those people go home.
And they go home and rest, right, with the exception, again, of the big Western shopping centers and such. They seem to just stay open.
And then how long are they open in the evening?
And then they're open till late at night, 9 or so at night. During Ramadan now this past month, because it's the month of fasting, then virtually nothing was open all day, and everything opened at 9 in the evening. So I went in with two friends of mine to cash our last paycheck, and it was real interesting that we didn't get to town till 9 o'clock, and everything was just coming to life then. And we were still there at midnight, and it was just alive. That's when everybody was doing their business. But of course, they're used to then. They stay up most of the night and eat. And then they, because they can't eat during the day, then they take it easy. But it made me angry that it's the children, that they are the ones that suffer, because they have to come to school during the day. You know, they have to be up at night eating, but they still have to come to school all day. They can't stay home and sleep. So these poor little guys have their big bags under their eyes and parched and sitting there looking so wasted.
What about the university students? Do they attend classes during the day?
No, but Ramadan University has, up as long as we've been there, ended right at the first day of Ramadan. So my husband, he was done with work May 8th. I wasn't done until June 4th, so we had the whole month. But now next year, word is that the university is going to go through Ramadan. Otherwise, we would have to, John would have to get out April 22nd. It keeps, because their calendar, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned it earlier, is a lunar year. It moves 11 days back every year. So the Ramadan shifts throughout the entire year, gradually. So next year it would be April 22nd, I believe. So either it's going to get to be where we're off in April and then come back in July, or they're going to have to shift and work through Ramadan. So I'm not sure what will happen if they actually do work through Ramadan. I think it'll be hard on the students and the teachers, too, I'm sure. They'll have a lot of tired students in their class. Yes, that's one of our benefits, is we get a round-trip ticket every year, so that's a big benefit. Some people do opt to stay. There are a few summer school opportunities for teachers. John has never chosen to apply for one, so we just don't like the heat, and things are so much quieter during the summer. Most of the people on campus are gone. It's just boring, to tell the truth, is what it is. So. Well, that's interesting. The question was if I've had a chance to talk to Saudi women. Very few, and I'm going to be dealing with that whole issue, another topic of the role of Saudi women in their society. But what happened was my husband got his master's degree in Portland, Oregon, the year before we went over there. And one of his students was a Saudi woman. And so when she found out, because he was teaching English as a graduate assistant, when she found out we were moving over there, it turned out they were going back to the same place we were. And so she was very excited about getting to meet me and getting to know us, and that was wonderful. We got together several times in Portland. We invited them to our house, sat around and had tea and goodies, and they kept stressing how we had to get together with them when we got over there. Well, then we got there before they did, so there was kind of a lapse. And then we just never heard. So finally we called one day and said, you know, we're here and it'd be nice to get together with you. But it was kind of a whole different feeling now in that culture. And they kind of said vaguely, yes, we'll have to get together, but never made any plans. And we were just real unsure what to do about it. Well, then these friends of ours, the ones I've told you who've studied a lot of Arabic, said that it's really up to us to invite ourselves over to them, to their house. That we should call and say, we'd like to stop by in such and such a time, which we found very difficult to do when we didn't know these people very well. One day we thought, oh, let's just do it. So we did. And they said that was fine. It was like 6 o'clock in the evening to stop by. And, oh, it was a comedy of errors, the whole thing was. We got there. First of all, it was a big ordeal to find their house. And then we found their house, and first there's an outer gate you walk through before you get to the house itself. And then the husband, Mohammed, met us at the door. And I knew that the men and women's sections were separate in the house, but I didn't know where to go. It was a big house. And so I kind of stood there awkwardly waiting for him to tell me what to do. And he motioned into the sitting room for John to go in there. And John said, and my wife? And he said, yes. So I followed him in there, knowing very well that was the men's sitting room, and I should not have been in there, but he didn't tell me where to go. That's I didn't know what else to do with myself. So I sat there feeling most uncomfortable. I kept my coat on, and I was kind of fidgeting, and Jenny was there. And finally, after 20 minutes, oh, and then Mohammed would say to John, how does your wife like it here? And he would answer to Mohammed, oh, she's happy here. Well, you know, what does she think of this? And he'd say, well, she thinks this. And I was sitting thinking, what am I doing here? Finally, he left the room, and I said to John, oh, I'm so embarrassed, I don't know what to do. And then he came back and he said to John, would your wife like to see Munira, which is his wife? And I just about leaped out of my chair. I wanted to. And so then he showed me how to get into the inner court, the women's quarters. And so then we sat and had a very nice long talk. And whereas the men's sitting room was very plush, white, velvet, sofas all around the edge with a huge TV at the end, the women's room was a carpet with cushions along the wall, nothing, not even to sit on. No cushioning to sit on. And that, oh, and an old rickety TV set that sat on the floor. I don't know if it worked or not. That was it. So I'm one of the few that got to see both. It's very unusual that you would get to have a woman would get to sit in the men's sitting room. So it was a real experience. So then it was so awkward because once I got in there and we got talking, of course, as soon as you have children, there's always a lot to talk about. And we had a real nice visit. And she kept asking me, how is Mr. John? How is Mr. John? And I'd say, oh, he's fine. And so she had a lot of questions about him. And then came the embarrassing moment where Mohammed came in with word that John says you have to leave. She said, why are you leaving? Why do you have to leave? I said, I don't know. You can't, don't even have eye contact. You can't even get, you know, little signals to each other. I said, oh, I think he has work to do, which wasn't true, but I thought, I have to make it sound like we have to, you know, I just didn't want it to be too awkward, although it was rapidly beginning to be so. It turned out then, and we had already been served tea and little snacks. Turned out then that they had dinner cooking, but nothing was ever said to us. And she brought us dinner on paper plates with foil over the top to bring home. I just felt terrible about that. I felt so awful. But John said later that he kept saying things to Mohammed like, you must be having dinner soon. And Mohammed said, yes. You know, and John said, I just wanted to know if we were going to be invited, and if not, then we should probably leave. So I guess the worst thing we could have done was leave, which we did. So after that, we didn't hear from them again, and we didn't call for the longest time until way next fall, 10:30 one night, Mohammed called and said, we want to come visit you. And John said, oh, well, yeah, fine. You know, come tomorrow evening. And he said, come for dinner. And apparently Mohammed said, no, you know, don't worry about dinner. But John said, well, come anyway. And so I was frantic the whole next day about preparing this dinner, not knowing, you know, in Portland, at our home, we all sat and ate together. Their home, it was all separate. Now, what do I do in my home, but in their country? I was really panicky all day about that. I was just a nervous wreck. We had to go shopping. I bought a huge leg of lamb. I bought all this big meal to present for them. And they were supposed to come at 6, so I figured, well, I'll prepare the meal ready at 8, because they generally do eat around 8. Well, 6 o'clock came, 6:30, 7:30, just nobody showed up. Finally, at about 7:45, John called Mohammed and said, are you coming? And he said, oh, a friend from Riyadh came. They wouldn't be coming tonight, you know. And never bothered to call, just, you know, and that's their way. You know, they, to them, well, John was livid. He was just furious. And I kept saying, well, you know, they said, don't worry about dinner. It was me that decided I should have this dinner prepared. So we had this huge feast, no company, so we called our good British friends who were always up for a good meal at 8 o'clock just as he was sitting down to his corned beef sandwich. He said, I'd love to come and eat leg of lamb. So, that's been my only real experience with the Saudi family. We have not gotten together with them since. They didn't call us back. By this point, we felt so awkward. We didn't know. Now should we call and invite them back to our house, or should we call and invite ourselves to their house? Or so nothing happened. And I kind of regret that, because all along I wanted to keep up that friendship, because it's very hard to get to know Saudi families. But
you mentioned that your Colorado friends, since they could speak Arabic, they did make friends. Did they fraternize or socialize with any of them?
Well, yes.
They did.
I don't think they've gotten to know any real well. It's been, I think it started with his students that they would say, could we visit your home? It was always them, and my, she said it's the hardest thing to do, to constantly say, can we come and visit you? Can we come and visit you? But they've persisted, and it's paid off.
Oh.
There'll be more.
Thank you.